I don't know, it seemed like a kind of a slow week, didn't it? There was the Super Bowl, to be sure. I'll have some words on that later. There was Michael Phelps with his bong. Sorry, couldn't think of anything to say about it. Why is it anyone's business? Then there was the stimulus and the tax cheats. We'll definitely be covering them. Otherwise, it was a kind of a snoozer. Perhaps it's just this cold weather slowing down my faculties. Well, let's see what we can squeeze out from the week's news. Regular Radio Derb listeners will know that our commentary on the government's bailout and stimulus packages these past few months has been balanced between the whence and the whither, which is to say between the matter of where the money's coming from and where it's going to. Conservatives this past few days have been having a lot of fun with the whither, uncovering the fact that our president's current stimulus package is mostly just thank-you payoffs to groups of Democrat tax-eaters and wealth destroyers. People like public sector unions, politically connected businesses, race and feminism lobbies, the bloated education rackets, and shakedown intimidator organizations like Acorn. Well, that's all good stuff, but while we're having fun with the whither, let's not lose sight of the whence. Where's the money coming from? We got a big part of the answer this week with the US Treasury's announcement that they will hold the largest ever bond auction next week, with $67 billion worth of Treasury securities on the block. The Treasury's also announced that secondary auctions of US government paper will be stepped up. They'll be held much more frequently than in the past. The stuff being sold at these auctions is all just basically IOUs. The buyer gets a piece of paper with a written promise on it. The promise is that he can redeem the bond at some stated future date for a stated sum of money, and in the meantime he will get a regular flow of interest payments. How much will people be willing to pay for that piece of paper? That depends on their own opinions about things like the future prospects for the currency of the payments, and whether they could do better by buying some other thing, and so on. That's why these sales are auctions. You don't know what the bonds will go for until punters show up and start bidding. As at any other auction, there's a reserve price, the price below which it's not worth the seller's while to make those commitments on redemption and interest. Might bidders fail to offer that price? They certainly might. In fact, this happened to the German government last month. The German Treasury held a bond auction, at the end of which they were left holding a third of the paper, unsold. In high finance circles, there is a very technical term for this situation. It's called a failed auction. Could this happen at one of these bigger and more frequent auctions of US paper? You bet. Not to worry, though. The Financial Times reports that, quote, the US Federal Reserve said last week it was prepared to buy treasuries if that would be a particularly effective way of reducing private borrowing costs, end quote. So, if private persons and banks and foreign governments won't buy these treasury securities that our government is issuing, well, heck, the government will just buy them itself. Nothing to worry about there, then. Shoe throwing is the new protest fad. This all started, of course, with Iraqi journalist Muntada al-Zaidi, who threw his shoes at President George W. Bush in Baghdad last December. Mr. Alzaidi was arrested by local police, who subjected him to a thorough interrogation. He will appear in court when his bones have set and the authorities have located his missing eyeball. He has become a celebrated hero around the Arab world, just as he would have if he'd thrown a shoe at Saddam Hussein or President Assad of Syria or Yasser Arafat or the Saudi king or Colonel Gaddafi or Mubarak of Egypt and so on. Arabs simply have no tolerance for leaders who mistreat their people. Well, shoe throwing took off after that. An anti-war group threw shoes at a Bush effigy outside the White House. French strikers threw shoes at police. A politician campaigning in the Ukraine, who thought he was going to be a shoo-in for office, instead got the shoe-at treatment from a protester. Strange permutations began to show up. Luiz da Silva, the president of Brazil, threatened to throw his shoes at unfriendly journalists in Sao Paulo. He unfortunately restrained himself, robbing sub-editors everywhere of the opportunity to make puns about the shoe being on the other foot. Then last week, a student in Cambridge, England, put his best foot forward. This was at an address given at Cambridge University by the very lifelike robot currently being trundled around Europe under the title Prime Minister of Communist China. Since China hasn't had a free election within living memory, it's hard to see how the place can have a parliament, much less a prime minister. However, the pretense of civilized politics must be kept up, so the Chaicoms hired some Japanese engineers to put together this android to keep the world distracted while they concentrate on the serious business of shoveling funds into their Swiss bank accounts while torturing Tibetan nuns and Falun Gong meditators. So, the golem was wheeled on stage at Cambridge, murmured a few of its pre-programmed phrases into the microphone, and then up stood our hero. He yelled, "We should not prostitute ourselves to this dictator," and he lobbed his loafer in the golem's direction. The mannequin had not been programmed for shoe avoidance, but fortunately the shot went wide. However, the device's circuits were sufficiently disrupted that it went into an endless loop, saying, "I'll die if I don't get this recipe. I'll die if I don't get this recipe. I'll die if I don't get this recipe." And it had to be wheeled off stage for maintenance. The peelers were called in to make an arrest, and London tabloids rushed to print headlines like "Flu Man's Shoe" and "Mu Shoe Guy Canned." Well, it all adds to the gaiety of nations, I suppose. I'd urge some care with throwing things at spokesmen for the Chinese government, though. Those gadgets are expensive. What do you get if you loan $250 million to the New York Times? You could ask Mexican multi-billionaire Carlos Slim, who made the loan 3 weeks ago. What is he getting for his investment? Well, he's getting lead editorials in the Times, like the one on February 1st, about, quote, "The relentlessly harsh Republican campaign against immigrants." Oh, tell me about it. This past election season, my immigrant self and my immigrant wife didn't dare to step outside the house for fear we'd be surrounded and clubbed to the ground by a posse of McCain-Palin operatives. The main target of the Times editorial was American Cause, which was founded by Pat Buchanan. Here is the clause on immigration from the American Cause website. Quote, "We believe assimilation and national unity should be the guiding principles in formulating immigration policy and support initiatives that end illegal immigration, reduce legal immigration to manageable levels, and emphasize integration of immigrants and their communities." End quote. Isn't that outrageous? I mean, free speech is all very well, but really? Initiatives that end illegal immigration? Assimilation and national unity? These people are obviously a gang of fascists. Well, American Cause had held a conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and this is what had occasioned Carlos Slim's fury, followed very closely, of course, by the New York Times' fury. Look at it from Mr. Slim's point of view. Without illegal immigration into the USA, Mexico has no safety valve for its huge, poor underclass. They might turn revolutionary, and that would be a major inconvenience for Mexican plutocrats, like, oh, say, Carlos Slim. Not that your average New York Times editorialist needs much encouragement to throw around phrases like white supremacist. They threw that precise phrase at the conference organizer, Marcus Epstein, who is a friend of mine. Marcus is a funny choice of guy to accuse of being a white supremacist. His mother is Korean and his dad is Jewish. A little thing like that won't stop the Times people when they have the bit between their teeth, though. Yeah, not to mention a $250 million worth of Mexican moolah stuffed into their pockets. It's a sad fact about life in this fallen world of ours that if you try to do someone a favour, he often ends up in worse shape than if you'd left him alone. When governments try to do people favours, this can be demonstrated on a heroic scale. Case in point, the plan by George W. Bush and Karl Rove to increase home ownership among minorities. The Bush-Rove plan was not disinterested, of course. These two political geniuses figured that if people were helped to own their own homes, they'd become Republican out of gratitude. How'd that work out? Well, as a political strategy, it was a total dud. As Radio Derb reported last week, John McCain's share of the Hispanic vote in November, for all his relentless hispandering, was less than George W. Bush's in 2004, even if you discount for the swing against Republicans overall. Now we learn from a Census Bureau report published Tuesday that the rate of home ownership has declined to the level it was at in 2000, and it's still dropping. This follows an Associated Press study put out January 18th, titled "Financial Burden of Home Ownership Spread Unequally." The study shows that, quote, "the burden is clearly more arduous among minority households," end quote. They're talking about the burden of unaffordable loan payments and mortgage defaults and foreclosures. Did Bush and Rove believe that they were doing good by leaning on banks and regulators to get more minorities buying houses? I'm sure they did. So I guess the moral is, beware of politicians trying to do you favours, especially politicians deeply invested in the theory that a drywaller making $500 a week will turn into a web designer making $2,000 a week just as soon as he owns his own home. Which is to say, beware of terminally stupid politicians who have zero contact with the real world of work and money. Which is to say, pretty much any politician at all. There's an old Chinese saying, and it's a real one, it's not one I've just made up, that goes like this. The rulers can burn whole mountains, but the common people dare not light a lantern. Something similar is true in any great imperial despotic system, where a permanent class of arrogant power holders, enjoying lifetime privilege, ride saddled and spurred on the backs of a helpless, powerless, overtaxed peasantry. The USA is headed in that direction rather fast. Our ruling class have not yet taken to burning mountains, but they definitely seem to have settled into the conviction that, as the great Leona Helmsley famously observed, we don't pay taxes, only the little people pay taxes. The trouble is, democracy in the USA is not completely dead yet, and once in a while, the rulers have to step forward and expose their financial affairs to us little people. When that happens, it seems that, as often as not, the mighty ones have been a tad careless about paying their taxes. This past few days, we've learned about Tom Daschle's $128,000 in unpaid taxes on a limo service he was given as a gift by a lobbyist. We've learned about Tim Geithner's $34,000 in unpaid income taxes. And about the $900 lien on Nancy Kilefer's house for unemployment taxes she didn't pay on her household help. And about the tax lien on Hilda Solis's husband that he'd left outstanding for 16 years. Daschle and Kilefer withdrew from consideration as executive officers, but Tim Geithner paid off precisely as much as he had to, left the rest unpaid, and slipped confidently into his new job as Secretary of the Treasury, a job that involves, among other things, making sure that we peons pay our income taxes and prosecuting us if we don't. I don't know Nancy Kilefer's party association, but the other characters in this little drama are all of the President's own party, as of course was Bill Richardson, Obama's choice for Commerce Secretary, who had to withdraw for legal reasons. Leader of the pack here, way out in front of these penny ante chiselers, is Representative Charlie Rangel, chairman of the House committee that actually writes tax laws. Rangel owns a villa in the Dominican Republic, which he rents out, but he's never declared the rental income on his tax returns. He's also been renting 4 apartments in New York City at sweetheart below-market rates and making improper use of congressional storage facilities. Now comes news that Rangel's been doing some major fudging of the numbers in those financial disclosure forms that House members have to submit every year. The fudging, we're told, goes back 30 years and covers nearly $250,000 in assets. House Republicans are trying to get the egregious Rangel removed from his committee job, but House Democrats are putting up stiff resistance. These are honest mistakes, they're telling us. Surely you don't think a member of Congress would do something wrong, do you? And a liberal Democrat at that? For shame. Republican Senator Jim DeMint summed up for conservatives everywhere on ABC's This Week program last Sunday. Quote, I can see now why liberals don't mind if the tax rate goes up, because they're not going to pay it anyway. End quote. Yes, indeed. The rulers can burn whole mountains, but the common people dare not light a lantern. So, how's young Barry Obama been doing this first 2 weeks in his new job? Of course, it's a bit unfair to pass judgment at this stage. You know how it is in a new place. Figuring out the controls on the coffee machine and the copier. Getting your desk drawers organized the way you like them. Sketching in the outlines of essential information about your colleagues. Who's the office gossip? Who's the office backstabber? The office freeloader? The office cougar? All that settling in stuff that you need to get straight before you can actually get any work done. Barry's done all right when you allow for the fact that he had to leave behind most of his friends in Chicago. You know, Tony Rezko, Bill Ayers, Jeremiah Wright. And hire in a bunch of strangers to help him get started. Previous charismatic Democratic presidents don't offer much detail for comparison. President Kennedy hired his brother as Attorney General. That option wasn't open to Obama, one of whose brothers is prospering as a businessman in South China and doesn't want to be bothered, while the other lives on a dollar a day in an African slum and has just been arrested on a drugs charge. Franklin Roosevelt went on the radio to tell Americans that the only thing we had to fear was fear itself. Obama just wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post trying to scare us out of our wits. Quote, "This recession might linger for years. Our economy will lose 5 million more jobs. Unemployment will approach double digits. Our nation will sink deeper into a crisis that, at some point, we may not be able to reverse." End quote. Hey, thanks for that, Mr. President. We all feel much better now. The object of the exercise here was, of course, to work up some public support for the stimulus bill. That bill, stuffed up to the staples with paybacks to activists and lobbyists, and with pork fat dripping out from between the pages. Lots of luck with this, Mr. President. I hope you got the coffee machine figured out. You're going to be needing lots of coffee. I think Communist China's brutal occupation of Tibet and ruthless campaign to stamp out that country's independence movement is pretty well known. Less well known is the situation in China's other big colony, East Turkestan, which the Chai Coms call Xinjiang. Xinjiang means new territory. The non-Chinese population of the place will tell you bitterly that while it may be new territory to the Chinese, they and their ancestors have lived there for thousands of years. These are the Uyghurs, a people quite closely related to the Turks of Turkey and to other Turkic peoples of Central Asia, like the Azerbaijanis, the Kazakhs and the Uzbeks. These are Muslim peoples, but like the Turks of Turkey, they take their Islam decaf and produce very few terrorists. East Turkestan was actually an independent state for a short time in the 1930s, when Russia and China were both looking the other way. Why should you care about any of this? Well, because 17 of the prisoners still in Guantanamo Bay are Uyghurs, captured in Afghanistan back in 2001. They were cleared for release 5 years ago, being non-dangerous, but there's trouble finding any country to take them. What about those brother peoples of the Uyghurs, the Kazakhs, the Azerbaijanis and the rest? What about Turkey, which has been hosting a free East Turkestan movement for decades? Ah, but you see, the Chai Coms have told everybody that taking in these Uyghurs would be a very unfriendly act. China wants these guys for itself. They have some experiments they'd like the Uyghurs to help them with. Seeing how well their eyeballs conduct electricity, stuff like that. China swings enough weight now that nobody wants to incur Chinese hostility, certainly not Central Asian states, with China just over the next mountain range. The European states have wimped out, of course, with the honourable exception of Albania, which took in 5 Uyghurs in 2006. You can add Canada to the wimp list. A rumour that Canada has agreed to take 3 Uyghurs was angrily denied by the Canadian government. I think it's a pretty good guess that these Uyghurs will end up in the USA. I don't have a problem with it myself, but it's a sorry state of affairs when all the other countries of the world are so intimidated by China that they won't help a handful of people whose country has been colonized and brutalized by Chinese imperialism. Here's our miscellany of brief items to close with. Item: Nancy Pelosi asked whether the stimulus package was being pushed through Congress too fast, replied that with 500 million Americans losing their jobs, Congress couldn't go fast enough. Well, you have to make allowances for our politicians. After 20 years of taking turns standing on the southern border, waving illegal immigrants through, it's natural for them to overestimate the number of people in the country. Item: perhaps Nancy was just trying for an approximation, the way you do when you don't really have a clue, but you want to have a number to show people. Here's a science story in that same vein. It's a report in the International Journal of Astrobiology. Yes, astrobiology. Now there's a field with a lot of data to work from. Well, some astrobiologists have been running sophisticated simulations of star systems to see how many other intelligent life forms there are likely to be in our galaxy, besides ourselves. The previous best estimate, they tell us, was somewhere between 1 million and less than 1. Which makes Nancy Pelosi look like a stickler for precision. The new estimate these researchers have come up with was between 361 and 38,000. Guys, if astrobiology doesn't work out for you, we could use those superlative numerical skills of yours at the US Treasury. Item: the thing about a recession is everything takes a hit. My pal Wally organises the Petrushka Ball, a big charity event for Russians in New York City, in aid of the Russian Children's Welfare Society. For the first time ever, he tells me, he's having trouble selling tickets. So, if you're Russian and you have $500 to spare for an excellent charity and you live near New York City, get your checkbook out. In a totally different sphere of public events, the NASCAR season will be opening next week with the Daytona 500. That's in trouble too, as you will understand if I just mention a couple of names of big sponsors: General Motors, Ford Motor Company. Right. I'm hearing that the NASCAR teams are cutting down on practice laps to save money. From charity balls to stock car races, everyone's hurting. Item: over in England, a cricket club named the Middlesex Crusaders has felt obliged to change its name to the Middlesex Panthers. There had been complaints from Muslim and Jewish persons who were still smarting from the humiliations and cruelties of 900 years ago, apparently having nothing more important to think about. So much for the second part of the club's name. I predict that now they're in the limelight, they will come under pressure from the transgender lobbies to do something about that Middlesex. It's actually the name of an English county, along with Essex and Sussex, But that won't cut any ice with the PC enforcers. Item, also in England, in the pretty little town of Weston-super-Mare, a nurse named Caroline Petrie, who is a Christian, was taking her leave after paying a home visit to 79-year-old May Phippen. As she gathered up her impedimenta, Nurse Petrie asked Mrs. Phippen if she'd like to be prayed for. "No, thank you," replied the irreligious Mrs. Phippen, with proper English sang-froid. Later, Mrs. Phippen mentioned the incident to another nurse, who alerted her superiors. Political correctness alarms sounded off all over Weston-super-Mare. A SWAT team from the Sensitivity Police tracked down Nurse Petrie, and she has now been suspended pending disciplinary action for, quote, breaching her code of conduct on equality and diversity. My advice to Nurse Petrie would be to convert to Islam. Then, any objections to her offers of spiritual succour would be hate crimes. Item. A cat may look at a king, goes the old proverb. Dogs don't show much respect for the mighty either, at least in France. When Napoleon climbed into bed with Josephine on their wedding night, he found that his bride was not alone. Under the covers with her was her little dog Fortuné. Displeased by the intruder, Fortuné gave Napoleon a nasty bite on the shin. That could dampen one's ardour, I should think. Anyway, history repeated itself, sort of, the other day when former French President Jacques Chirac was attacked by Sumo, his pet Maltese poodle. Chirac's wife Bernadette explained that Sumo has become increasingly violent in recent years and is being treated with antidepressant medications. Well, after a few years of close acquaintance with the obnoxious Chirac, I think anyone might be similarly disposed. It was a French lady, I believe, Madame Roland, who made the immortal observation that, quote, the more I see of men, the more I admire dogs. Well, there are two dogs worthy of our admiration right there. Item, my producer tells me that I should say something about the Super Bowl. All right, I'll give it a try. I'm what they call a sideline dad. My son plays football, so there I am on the sidelines at his games. If it's a home game, I try to get on the chain crew, just because I like to make myself useful. Pretty much all I know about football comes from working on the chain crew. So, here's the Super Bowl commentary from a sideline dad. I thought the guys in Tampa did a great job. I didn't see an inch of slack in those chains, and the handling of the down boxes was faultless, so far as I could tell. Clement Brooks, the chain crew captain, looks as though he's ready for retirement, though. The important thing about working the chain crew is to drop your pole and get out of the way real fast when a 240-pound wide receiver is headed your way at a full run. For speedy retreat, you need to keep constant tabs on the positions and the blocking potential of all the coaches, officials, and photographers a few yards behind you. You have to be always on the lookout for that hole, you see. When your reflexes start to slow and you lose your attention, it's time to get out. Now, I'm sure Clement knows that, and I'm sure he'll step aside with proper grace and dignity in the spirit of the game. There are some fine young talents coming up in the chain crews, and I look forward to more exciting action on the sidelines in future Super Bowls. There now, that was my first ever Super Bowl commentary. I hope you liked it. That's about it for this week. Not really very much going on, in fact. Even as I speak, though, Radio Derb's diligent and tireless core of researchers is fanning out across the world for news items to bring to you. So, tune in again next week for more revelations, ruminations, and retrogradations from Radio Derb.